Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Garrett Rebenhagen, who is an Iraq veteran who served as a sniper in the Army's 1st Infantry Division. He participated in the attacks on Fallujah and testified that white phosphorus was used on that city. And recently, Garrett Rebenhagen has been outspoken in his support for Representative John Murtha's public statements about the Haditha massacre. So we'll be looking into that from a soldier's point of view. And we'll also talk David Reif, who has an article in today's New York Times magazine entitled "The Populist at the Border." This profiles Andres Manuel López Obrador, the former mayor of Mexico City, and his bid to become the president of Mexico in the upcoming July 2nd elections, and in the context of a fear, particularly here in our media, that yet another Central and South American country will turn to the left. We'll also speak with James Carroll, who's a former priest who's been a civil rights worker, an anti-war activist, and a community organizer in Washington, D.C. His father was the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency. He served as a Catholic chaplain at Boston University, and he was the recipient of the first Thomas Merton Award. He has a new book, House of War, The Pentagon and the Disastrous Rise of American Power. And I'm speaking now with Garrett Rebenhagen, who, as I mentioned, is a veteran. He's a former sniper with the Army's 1st Infantry Division, who participated in the attacks on Fallujah and testified that white phosphorus was used on that city. And he has been in the media quite a bit lately speaking in support of Representative John Murtha's public statements about the Haditha massacre. And Garrett, we had a few months ago Bobby Gulshan from Time magazine, who originally broke the story. And he apparently received a videotape from a freelance or student journalist in Iraq who had documented the aftermath of the killings in these houses in Haditha. And apparently it went through the Naval NCIS, the Naval Investigative Services, and now John Murtha has leaked that it's for real. Nothing's happened yet, but I imagine there will be some kind of announcement soon and eventually some kind of trial. How do you feel about the idea of your fellow soldiers being put on trial for murder?
Well, it's a tough situation. I mean, first, I want to thank you for having me on the show. Let me express my point of view as another soldier. You got to understand that in this situation, the soldiers that are responsible, they're in a very difficult situation at the time. In no way are the attacks really justified. You can't justify anything like that, just like you can't really barely justify the entire war and the entire occupation at this point. In my opinion, it's all an atrocity to me. The things that are ongoing every day in Iraq are an atrocity, and it's hard because we put our men and women in uniform in that situation, and they're pushed to the point to basically get into the mindset to do these kinds of things. Basically, I think the situation, whether they're guilty or not, is not the point any longer. The fact is, I think that as John Murtha is one of the few people who have seen this report. Of course, I haven't, so I can't tell you exactly what happened or what didn't happen. And of course, I wasn't at the actual situation. But the men involved, this Marine company, this is not their first deployment to Iraq. They've been churned through it time and time again now. They're in the battles of Fallujah 1 and 2. They get sent back a year later to Haditha. They lose 6 snipers on a roof. They lose 14 men to an IED that hit their armored personnel carrier. And then finally, this one last straw of this one soldier being killed. These Marines were already stressed out. They're already no strangers to combat situations. What I think is this key issue here is they didn't get the treatment, the mental health care that they needed, not when they came home from the first two battles of Fallujah and that deployment. They didn't seek mental health care because there's a stigma on soldiers seeking mental health care. They didn't receive professional one-on-one counseling. They're sent back to Iraq, probably not mentally fit for combat, and more and more combat was pressed upon them. More and more soldiers were killed, and they weren't pulled from duty. They weren't given the rest and recuperation that they needed. And this kind of atrocity happens. And if we don't look at the healthcare of our soldiers in combat, And, you know, this modern day of combat, we have the ability to help our soldiers and to make sure that they're mentally fit for combat. And right now we're failing to do that, and that's why we're going to see more of these atrocities.
But I imagine, Garrett Rebenhagen, it's got to be stressful, apart from the stress of battle, which is impossible to describe to anybody who hasn't experienced it. And secondly, you've got this fear constantly of being blown up by these IEDs. And many soldiers have been blown up on several occasions without losing lives or limbs. So it's almost a regular occurrence every time you go out. Everybody in the country seems to be the enemy. I mean, first of all, how as a soldier in the field do you adjust to this kind of mind warp that you were sent over there to liberate these people and they're shooting at you and you're killing them, and killing people is hardly a way to liberate them?
Well, it's true. I mean, soldiers right now are constantly faced with the conflict of the ambiguous reasons of why we went to the war. It's ever changing. You know, we're always trying to make up new excuses of why we're there and justify the reasons why we need to stay there. And soldiers are beginning to ask themselves, am I making these sacrifices for a good cause? Am I being lied to? Is this fraudulent? And then, of course, we're being told that we're giving these people democracy, that we're giving them freedom, and then they're attacking us. And the way they attack us is with these weapons where there's no obvious enemy to retaliate against. And after you get hit by an improvised explosive device, a roadside bomb or a vehicle bomb, and you got your adrenaline flowing, you're frustrated, you're angry, all you want to do is retaliate against somebody, some sort of enemy, and that's not provided. So you're still left with this frustration where you ask the Iraqi people nearby, you know, trying to get some sort of information to help you out, to help them out, and you don't get any cooperation, and that's extremely frustrating. So, it's my belief. Of course, I wasn't there, so I can't speak for the men. But after we've gotten hit by roadside bomb after roadside bomb, you get in that mentality where you're playing these mind games, where you see somebody running from the scene, and you want to shoot him because you're questioning, is he the trigger man? Why is he running so fast? You know, why is that guy not running at all? What about that guy at the Haji Shack or that farmer standing in the field? Could all these people be the trigger man, or, you know, have at least been a spotter for the trigger man? And you get to the point where you think, well, maybe if I just kill everybody who's right here, either I'll kill the person who did it or I'll make that person stop trying to blow us up. And you play these head games the entire time you're there, and it's very difficult, and it's a psychological battle the entire time.
Well, even if the people aren't complicitous in any way, and they obviously do have spotters for these IEDs, which are often triggered by cell phones, the truth of the matter is that everybody in the neighborhood, at least all the Sunnis, were in effect in a sectarian war fighting the Sunnis, and that's probably why the Shia haven't gone after us, except for a little occasion with Muqtada Sadr's militia. But by and large, the Shiites are killing the Sunni. And just today, they haul people out of cars, ask them if your name is Omar, which is a popular Sunni name. They shoot you on the spot. So in effect, what's happened to the United States military there? If we become just another militia, lost in all of this bloodshed and anarchy. But in the videotape that Bobby Ghosh got hold of from Time magazine, from the human rights guy, there was one young girl, I think 12 or 13, that survived the massacre by lying under the bodies in Haditha, and she was interviewed as one of the main sources. And in a more extended version of the interview, apparently she mentioned how they heard the convoy coming and they were waiting for the bomb, which indicates, of course, that they knew about the bomb. That's not to say that they're any way guilty, but the point I'm trying to make is that we're in a guerrilla war, and the people are against us, aren't they?
Well, a lot of the people don't openly actually join the insurgency, but they do, you know, they do support them and they do encourage them. And
well, it's their brothers and their cousins and their uncles and their fathers, right?
That's true. If to have a guerrilla warfare, like I said, the population has to support the guerrillas, or else they'll be ratted out. They'll be informed upon. They won't be able to be fed. They won't be able to be supplied. They won't be able to move. And, you know, all these things are dependent upon by the local population. And certainly right now, the American occupation is polarizing the nation. When I first got there, there wasn't very many people that really classified themselves, whether they are Shia or Sunni. They considered themselves Iraqi or Arab or Persian. And now, you know, we're really seeing this divide, the sectarian divide that's causing this strife. And we are the hitman for the for right now the Shia dominated areas. And you know, a lot of our airstrikes and a lot of our bombing campaigns, a lot of our raids are based off of information that we get from Shia population or the militia, the Iraqi army, which is dominated by Shias and Kurds. And you know, it's not something where the United States forces are actually preventing violence. If anything, we're escalating the violence. And you know, the more soldiers we put in there, you know, it's not necessarily going to change anything, because right now we're not doing anything as it is.
Well, of course, there was a British Army officer who recently critiqued the U.S. tactics, and apparently this got the sympathy of, I believe, the new number two, General Chara, I think his name is, who was responsible largely for refocusing on Haditha, which had been swept under the rug by the investigative services inside the Pentagon. And the British do have a less confrontational approach. But I guess things are so bad now that the soldiers don't want to take a building that they can have it bombed. You know, why lose your life kicking a door down if you can blow it up?
You also got to realize that the British forces mostly operate in Basra, mm-hmm. in the south, and it's a completely different environment. It's Shia dominated.
Right.
It's not in the Sunni triangle. It's a different war. There's a good three major sections of Iraq that are very different, maybe even four if you count the areas near the Syria border. And there's different tactics that have to be used, and in no way is it a safe place to be. It's not a safe place to operate either in Basra, but it's a very different situation. I know this one British soldier that critiqued it did operate in Baghdad for 3 months, but 3 months is not nearly the 6 months the Marines are pulling multiple times in the 1 year that the active army soldiers are pulling in these areas within the Sunni triangle. So it's hard to judge. You've got McMaster that did a brilliant counterinsurgency near the Syrian border. He couldn't have used those same tactics in, let's say, Fallujah, because it's a different area of operation.
Sure. Well, I think it's the point I'm making, Garrett, is that it's maybe it's too late for hearts and minds, that we've just blown it so badly there that the only answer is to get out.
Well, I think we've blown it on the initial opening up. I mean, how do you win hearts and minds with shock and awe?
Sure. I agree with you.
Find shock and awe, you know, and shock and awe is, you know, if you see a show and you define it as shocking, you know what I mean? It's not something that you think that, you know, it's going to build the confidence of the local people if you're trying to scare the crap out of them. I mean, that's just terrorist tactics in and of itself. So who are we? Just a bunch of hypocrites.
I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Garrett Reppenhagen, who was a sniper with the Army's 1st Division in Iraq. And let's now go to the subject of the Mexican elections. I'm speaking with David Reif, who's a political analyst and cultural critic who has written widely on war, genocide, and human rights for many publications, including the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the New Yorker, Harper's, the Atlantic Monthly. He is a contributing editor to the New York Times Magazine and a contributing editor to the New Republic. Mr. Reif is also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, the New York Institute for the Humanities, and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute at the New School for Social Research. His latest book is At the Point of a Gun, Democratic Dreams and Armed Intervention, and he has an article in today's New York Times Magazine entitled The Populist on the Border, on Andres Manuel López Obrador, the former mayor of Mexico City, on his bid to become the president of Mexico in the July 2nd elections. And he looked like a shoo-in there until he made this incredibly boneheaded decision not to participate in the debate. So does this guy have the political instincts of, say, Mondale, Gore, and John Kerry?
Well, I don't know if... I mean, he's made a lot of boneheaded decisions. He didn't participate in the debate, and so they left an empty lectern along with the other candidates. He was on the receiving end of a great many attack ads comparing him to Hugo Chavez and implying a connection to Fidel Castro, although not explicitly making one. And he didn't reply. And then he was angry, quite understandably, that the president of Mexico, the current president, Vicente Fox, who is, of course, of the same party as López Obrador's principal opponent, Felipe Calderón. Fox has used the power of his office to campaign for Calderón and against López Obrador, and López Obrador got annoyed and called him a chacalaca, which is apparently some version, I may be mispronouncing it, a small twittering tropical bird. And the Mexican, that didn't go well. People don't like that They felt it was there was a kind of sense maybe nobody likes Vicente Fox much these days, but they don't like attacks on the president. Or at least that's what people say. So he having really seemed to be sweeping the table, is now, you know, they can't get anything right in that campaign. And my own view is it's less Mondale than a certain kind of populist sense of mission. I mean, what struck me about López Obrador is not so much, I don't think he's the next Hugo Chavez, but he is a rather classic kind of populist. You know, in North America, someone I talked to, who admittedly is an opponent, compared him to Huey Long in the U.S. The comparisons to Perón and to other figures in Latin American politics seem, historical Latin American politics seem pretty easy to make. And those guys often have a sense of their own invulnerability, a sense of their own, a certain messiah-like sense of themselves, frankly, saviors of their country, saviors in Long's case of Louisiana. I don't know if that's really going to work in Mexico. Certainly right now, even if the polls are tighter than they look, there's no doubt López Obrador has lost a lot of ground, and there's no doubt that we've gone from an election that was absolutely his to lose to an election that he very well could lose.
But of course, the deck's always been stacked in Mexico against the PRD, and in 1988, Cuauhtemoc Cárdenas is widely believed to have won, and Salinas burned the ballots. That leads me to some puzzlement I have in terms of that one of the more important players down there is the fellow from the jungle that with the hood over his head, who basically humiliated Cárdenas in his second run, there's a picture of him shaking hands, Comandante Marcos shaking hands with López Obrador, that apparently the PAN advertising campaign is using against López Obrador. But so what's the strange relationship there? Why is it that it appears that the Zapatista leader is actually bent on humiliating the left rather than supporting it?
Well, you know, that on one level I could say, I suspect you know this history, and I'm sure many of your listeners know this history better than I do. Historically, you know, the left has never fought with its enemies when it can fight with its friends. I mean, you know, it's absolutely true that Subcomandante Marcos, as one must call him, I hate using military titles, but there it is, his choice, that he has actually, if anything, when the Mexican campaign started in earnest after the first of the year, Marcos organized what he called the other campaign, La Otra Campaña, and that campaign was meant to provide, as it were, an alternative to electoral politics. But as you say, the emphasis of his campaign was to attack López Obrador, not to attack Calderón. I suppose the assumption is we know that the right is terrible, but now we're going to reveal that this so-called leftist candidate is just as bad. So So there's a court of, I mean, during the years of lead in Italy, the Red Brigades had a slogan, tanto peggio, tanto meglio, which roughly translated means so much the worse, so much the better. I have a feeling Marcos and some of his supporters, both in Chiapas and in various Mexican universities, subscribe to that view. I think if they get what they wish, they'll discover that worse really is worse, but that's my view, not necessarily one that your listeners need to take seriously.
But is there anything, though, to the notion that this is a former priest coming out of the most corrupt of the pre-states, Tabasco? When he was mayor of Mexico City, his finance chief apparently was frequenting the Bellagio Hotel casinos here in Vegas. $3 million disappeared of municipal funds, and also López Obrador's personal secretary was caught on videotape receiving $45,000 from a Mexico City businessman. Yet this doesn't apparently affect the affection of his court support, who see him as a kind of deliverance from the oligarchs. So where do you see him? Is he a reformed oligarch, or is he a real populist?
Well, I'm afraid for me, real populist is not a compliment when I use it. In other words, I think he is a real populist. I don't think... I'm not at all persuaded he's a man of the left. I think that may be the mistake that people make. I mean, was Huey Long of... Huey Long was a real populist. Juan Perón was a real populist. I mean, the career of Perón is quite interesting. When Perón came back from his second exile, that is to assume the presidency of Argentina for the second and last time, he gave a very odd speech at the airport, and he said, "We're going to have a new dispensation." I mean, I'm paraphrasing. In Argentina, we're going to share things. Half for the rich, half for the poor. And then switching into English, he said, 50-50. And I think that's what López Obrador is doing. I mean, there's no doubt that López Obrador is in excellent terms with a lot of the major oligarchs, as you put it. And I think it's the right terminology, because in many ways, Mexico, before Fox, resembled the Soviet Union, and Mexico, after the fall of the resembles Yeltsin's Russia. So they probably are oligarchs, but I think what you get is a combination of populist themes, a sort of humiliation of people in power, but largely symbolic. Some real social welfare programs. After all, the reason López Obrador is so amazingly popular in Mexico City, even despite those corruption scandals that you mentioned, despite, in fact, the crime rate going skyrocketing during his tenure, and despite the fact that he did nothing to stem the decay of the physical infrastructure of Mexico City, at least anything you didn't see. He built some roads, but he didn't, for example, take care of sewage or you know, underground electric lines or anything like that. I think what makes him popular is he got, you know, there were these payments for the elderly, and that's a standard trope of populist politics. And that's where I see him. I've never heard anyone say that he's personally corrupt. What I've heard repeatedly is that he tolerates corruption, that corruption and loyalty, that loyalty is more important to him, and that these guys that you mentioned before, the fellow who had this gambling habit in Vegas, and the other one who apparently was drawing three salaries from the city government of Mexico, or rather the government of the federal district, López Obrador prized their loyalty and ignored their corruption, and one has, I'm afraid I don't see any evidence that that's going to change. The other thing worth saying, I think, in terms of the Mexican politics is that, current Mexican politics, is that López Obrador has put together basically everyone who didn't either stay in the PRI or was part of the PAN, so dissident people of the PRI, including the former mayor of Mexico City, Manuel Camacho Solis, including Arturo Nunez Gutierrez, who's a famous economist in Tabasco, who's going to probably be the PRD senator down there if he wins. A lot of people from as it were, the left side of the PRI have joined him, and a lot of people in the PRD. What's interesting, you referred correctly to the, I don't even think it's debatable myself from everyone I've talked to, that the left won the election of 88 and that Cuauhtemoc Cardenas was absolutely elected president. Cardenas has not backed López Obrador. He's really kept his distance from him. He hasn't opposed him, but he hasn't backed him. And when I spoke to Cardenas, when I was doing this piece for the Times, I was struck by the degree to which he seemed to be taking, in the politest possible way, a kind of plague on both their houses' positions.
And the other PRD guy who ended up working for the PAN regime that's now finishing its sexenio, he, Castaneda, who was their foreign minister, doesn't seem to be too high on López Obrador either.
No, he's absolutely, I think, is supporting Calderón. I think that Jorge Castaneda takes the view that, not that he doesn't buy for a second this Hugo Chavez stuff. I mean, I have talked to him at some level.
Well, that seems to be largely an American invention, isn't it?
You get different stories. I had always understood that Dick Morris, the famous Clinton triangulator,
the toe sucker.
Yeah, the toe sucker, exactly. And now Hillary's. He has the hindquarters of a stag, this man. I saw him once on a shuttle plane to Washington. Anyway, that he had been advising the Calderon campaign, but the Calderon campaign people deny this. They say that they they talked to him and then decided not to employ him. I don't know. He didn't exactly return my phone call, so I don't know what the truth of the matter is. But I know that they're following a style that people like Lee Atwater and Morris and others were pioneered, which was the slash and burn politics of, they're basically swift boating López Obrador, to use another image. And those attacks work, we all know that.
So what's going on, though, in terms of, here we've witnessed in the United States hundreds of thousands of immigrants marching in the streets here, in a way, putting us to shame. These are people who can't even vote in many cases, and they're exercising their political muscle, and it's created, obviously, a big story on the other side of the border, where I understand, as you write in today's New York Times magazine article on López Obrador, that the resentment at the treatment of Mexican immigrants in the United States is at fever pitch in Mexico. So how's that going to play out? Because there's an enormous irony here that since NAFTA, and particularly under the reign of the PAN leader Fox, there's been an enormous exodus of people from Mexico. And the joke is that the 10 million jobs that Fox promised Mexicans, unfortunately, are all in the United States.
Yes, that is the joke. I would say probably two things are worth noting. The first is that López Obrador is, if anything, he's very calm about the immigration matter. It's Calderón at his rallies who says things like, we won't allow the flag of Mexico to be disgraced by, the Americans. Even though, of course, that privately Calderón and the PAN have, ties up and down the food chain with the American government, with American business, et cetera, et cetera.
And the Bush family, too.
And, of course, the Bush family, indeed. But, in fact, Calderón, if anything, is a bit more playing to the gallery in his talk. López Obrador is very calm. He emphasizes that just creating jobs in Mexico to keep Mexicans, to make it possible for Mexicans not to go north. He emphasizes that the solutions are Mexican. He does talk about renegotiating elements of the NAFTA, but he doesn't really emphasize that. The real thrust of his talk, including about immigration, is that Mexico could become a rich country if it were properly administered.
And I think he's absolutely right, though, isn't he? The country's been systematically looted as long as I can remember.
He may well be right. The question is whether, A, he's the man to do it, and B, whether it can be done at this point. I mean, looting is, it has been looted, indeed. It's been looted since, been looted since the Buckley family was in the oil business down there in 1915. But it's also been looted, and probably more comprehensively, let's be clear. I mean, it's the point Carlos Fuentes always makes. You criticize American policy toward Mexico till the cows come home, but the Mexican elite is the principal villain in this piece. And, you know, the Escobar, I mean, they mint, there's a man you probably know, Paco Ignacio Taibo II, the son, the thriller writer, very left, very rather a supporter of subcomandante Marcos, although he, Taibo, I mean, I believe is supporting López Obrador in this cycle. And Taibo said, you know, we mint millionaires here by the bushel. We, you know, the generation of wealth among the rich in Mexico is really like Russia in the early 90s. And
these are people who live gated lives.
Yeah, that was an Australian friend of mine who's working in Mexico at the moment put it to me that way. She was quite startled to find herself in armored cars going to dinner.
Well, tell me, though, about the apparent kind of insularity of López Obrador. It sort of reminds me of George W. Bush in the sense he's never traveled abroad except to Cuba, and Bush only went to Israel and Rome before he became president. So he's never been to the United States?
There's some debate about that. I had assumed he hadn't been to the United States, and then one of his aides said, oh, he'd been once, but he never talks about any abroad. He certainly, you know, I don't want to play into stereotypes about him. He is not, doesn't talk about Cuba either. It's not as if the visit is emblematic of anything. He was a, you know, probably more to the left as a young man when he made this trip, but we're not talking about Evo Morales, who's constantly sort of sitting in Fidel Castro's lap in the photographs. We're talking about a man who is, in many ways, a very old-fashioned Mexican nationalist. And what you were saying before, that Mexico is indeed as maladministered and could be a rich country. The question is whether López Obrador's prescription, which to my ears often sounds a lot like autarky, is a really viable way of bringing on that prosperity.
Well, you also point out in your article, David Reif, that Carlos Slim, the third richest man in the world, one of the oligarchs, supports him.
Right? Yes. I mean, he doesn't, you know, he's...
But he doesn't, he's not against
he
him.
Doesn't, he's absolutely not against him. He supported him a lot when López Obrador was head of Mexico City, chief of government in Mexico City, and... I don't know at all that López Obrador would bring the kinds of changes that Mexicans would profit from. Having said that, you look at the faces of the people at a López Obrador rally, and you see people who, for whom he feels like the last best hope.
You're talking about people who live on, what, $2 a day or something?
There are a lot of people in Mexico who live on, said to be almost, out of something like 95 or 100 million Mexicans, it's said there are 20 million living on $2 a day.
Well, I mean, any improvement.
Well, exactly.
What are we talking about here?
Yes.
I mean, well, look, I thank you so much for joining us. This is obviously going to be an exciting race here. And we've got about a month to go, I guess.
July 2nd, yeah.
Yes, and the PRD is the orphan party of Mexican politics. As you say, they won in 88. So
they already won in 88. Yeah, they're a little overdue.
Exactly. So thanks for joining us, sir. And
sure.
Thanks for your article in today's New York Times.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with David Reif, is the author of an article in today's New York Times Magazine entitled The Populists of the Border on Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who's running for president in the July 2nd Mexican elections. Now, let's go to the subject of the House of War. I'm speaking with James Carroll, who was raised in Washington, D.C. His father was an Air Force general and the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, and he became a civil rights worker, an anti-war activist, community organizer, and then was ordained into the priesthood. He became the Catholic chaplain at Boston University, and he also became a columnist for the National Catholic Reporter. And for his writing on religion and politics, he received the first Thomas Merton Award. His new book is House of War, The Pentagon and the Disastrous Rise of American Power. And that, of course, is a quote from President Eisenhower's famous farewell address, where he first coined the phrase the military-industrial complex, where he warned of the disastrous misplaced, I can't remember exact words, but rise of America, misplaced power in America. And here we are with a defense budget that is the highest since World War II. We outspend the world on defense, all the world combined. And yet, we seem to be the Republic of Fear. So what's it all buying us?
Well, that's a good set of questions and observations. I would say that in House of War, what I do is I track the story of the way in which exactly that phenomenon that Eisenhower warned of has come true. He saw it unfolding on his own watch, of course. The thing that is astounding about the last 60 years in America is the way in which military power has subtly and powerfully taken over the center of American culture without our paying any particular attention to it. Periodically, there's a military catastrophe of some kind that draws our attention to it. We're seeing one unfold now in Iraq. What's being revealed? Obviously, what's being revealed is the limits of military power. We are, as you say, investing so much of our treasure in it, and yet it buys us very little. We are being fought to a tragic and a catastrophic stalemate in Iraq today by a relatively small group of so-called insurgents.
Well, you could argue, though, that even though the Bush administration, who have literally opened the treasury doors to the military-industrial complex, and now they're double-dipping because they have this phenomenon of the contractors fulfilling contracts that the military soldiers themselves used to do, like feed themselves and logistics, etc. So they're, as I say, double-dipping, and clearly the invasion of Iraq has turned the United States into a paper tiger, because it's put our boys and girls in harm's way with no mission, no exit strategy, and no chance of winning. But that doesn't mean we're not a powerful nation. So it gets me to the question again, which is what we saw during the Cold War, is we were spending an enormous amount of money on piling up nuclear weapons, both us and the Soviets, in this sterile standoff where the best that they could promise you was that you'd be dead, but 20 minutes later they'd all be dead. I mean, you might as well have given your money to the mafia. At least they would have broken a few knees.
Well, you're right to draw attention to nuclear weapons. I actually believe that nuclear weapons are the key to this mystery. Nuclear weapons are still, despite the end of the Cold War and the disappearance of the our antagonist in the Cold War, we've still maintained Cold War, not only Cold War levels of our nuclear arsenal, but a Cold War mindset about them. We still have massive Trident submarines prowling the seas. We still have nuclear ICBMs on ready alert. We have thousands of these monstrous weapons ready to be fired within a matter of a few minutes. And why? Protecting us from what? This weapon system has absolutely no relationship to anything that threatens the United States of America today. Well, clearly something else is being satisfied by this. Partly you can account for it in economic terms, I believe, because nuclear weapons are still at the center, the dead center of the nuclear arms industry. And there's, I believe, a kind of mystical component to this a phenomenon as well. There's a way in which, going right back to 1945, the transcendent power that seemed available to us with the use of the atomic bomb, that somehow we've put a kind of faith in this thing, which is the only way to account for our inability to think about it directly, to talk about it. We treat it as if it's a holy of holies. We treat it as if it's a kind of religious icon. The thing is mad. It's the center of a national insanity, and we simply must learn how to think rationally about this weapon system. Of course, we're re-embracing it now. That's what the Bush administration is up to, and our commitment to a new generation of nuclear weapons is, of course, a major part of what's driving other nations to resume their quest for this weapon system as well, not
least Iran.
Well, it's commonly believed that our short-lived nuclear monopoly, starting with the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, after which there weren't too many weapons available in any case, but that was a deep, dark secret that we had. But the long and the short of it is that Stalin knew all along what was going on, and he wasn't particularly worried. What he was concerned about, it turns out, was the Marshall Plan. So it seems that our militarization of this competition with the Soviets ended up sort of basically only benefiting the military-industrial complex, and that had we used our other tools more wisely, then perhaps we could have brought about the end of this sort of phony war much quicker.
Well, the phenomenal thing that took off at that very moment was this huge growth in nuclear weapons. Americans have paid very little attention to the irrational and rapid escalation of our nuclear arsenal. In 1950, we had something like 200 atomic bombs. By 1960, when Eisenhower warned of this phenomenon, the nuclear arsenal in the United States had grown to almost 19,000. It was entirely irrational. 19,000 weapons was vastly beyond any possible reasonable war plan. And yet something had been set loose that no one by then was in charge of. And, of course, the upward escalation continued for the next three decades.
But so the military-industrial complex were sort of an accident of World War II, the result of the arsenal of democracy. Then there was a brief period where we had the best years of our lives to characterize that wonderful movie, and then they made a comeback. And then now, of course, they're so entrenched that they're just worse than pigs at the trough. They're just stealing us blind. So how do they reinvent themselves then?
Well, what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex really should be called the military-industrial congressional media academic labor complex. All of the great elements of American society have been drawn into this dynamic.
Well, of course, he was prompted to say that because he was so exasperated with the Democrats, you know, these Symington and all of the, and Jackson, the senator from Boeing and others. And remember, Jack Kennedy was running a campaign then against Nixon, saying that the Republicans were soft on communists.
Indeed so. And Symington both hammered on something called the missile gap, which was a fantasy. What's you know, relevant for us is the way in which this system has paralyzed American politics. One wonders why the Democrats are never able to mount a serious critique of Republican foreign policy. Well, of course, it's because the Democrats are locked into the same system as the Republicans. The vast amounts of treasure that the government commits to military industry gets recycled back into the campaign funds of the politicians who vote the appropriations bills. It's an endless cycle, and everyone in American politics at the federal level is imprisoned by it.
Yeah, it's kind of like right-wing welfare.
It is indeed, and of course it's right-wing, it's left-wing, it's liberal,
right.
It's Democrat, it's conservative, it's the whole culture, which is why we don't get a critique of this. On the front page of the New York Times 3 days ago was a story on the up above the fold on the right-hand column about reinventing the Trident missiles, the Trident submarines, ICBMs, to give them an entirely new purpose.
Right, with conventional warheads, that would be the most expensive way to drop a few tons of TNT.
Yes, and it's very clear there's only one possible rationale for this thing, which is to give the Tridents, which have no reason for being in existence,
right,
to give them a new raison d'etre. It's insanity. And where has been the political conversation about this? Where has the protest been? Where have the editorials been? We're recommissioning the Trident submarine system instead of mothballing it, putting it out to pasture, retiring it. It's a relic of the Cold War. It has absolutely no justification for continuing to exist.
And all the attack submarines are used as intelligence platforms, so and for special forces. So I mean, obviously the canard that was floated, though, during that critical period in the post-war period was that if you were progressive domestically in your politics, you were therefore aiding and abetting the Soviet Union. That's essentially the canard that McCarthy hoisted.
Yes, it's true.
And now, to some extent, Bush and Rove are continuing this canard with if you're not for their war on terror, you're therefore aiding and abetting the terrorists.
Well, you know, so much of this discussion is framed in terms of realism. But realism, an authentic realism today would help us confront the fact that our defense establishment does nothing to protect us from the possibility of terrorists. I believe that terrorism can be a real threat to the United States of America, but there is nothing that the Pentagon does that protects us from terrorism.
Or Homeland Security.
Nothing. There is no such thing as security that's being created in the Pentagon. It's a complete fantasy.
The two things that 9/11 told us, and a few people in the intelligence world understand this, was that what the two imperatives after 9/11 were: one, to secure the fissile material in the former Soviet Union, because a lot of people know how to build a bomb, they just don't have the fuel to make it work. So, and instead of continuing the Nunn-Lugar account, Bush started to cut money from it, which is so counterintuitive, it's criminal. And secondly, the other aspect is that we don't know who lives in this country. There are 20 million people unaccounted for, so we need to do some kind of inventory. And you can see that this is all tied into the immigration debate, but neither of these things are happening. So the whole thing is a hoax, but that hasn't stopped President Bush from pounding away every day. He reminds us that he is a wartime president. I'm the war president.
It's true, and everywhere we look, we see a further militarization of our culture. The symbolic importance of General Hayden's taking over the CIA, a traditionally civilian agency, even if it has a quasi-military function. There was something important about the insistence down through the decades that the director of the CIA was a civilian. Next, we'll have a Secretary of State or a Secretary of Defense who's an active duty military officer. I mean, these distinctions actually matter quite a lot. It matters that the Border Patrol, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, not be a function of the United States Army.
Bush's answer to the border is, apart from the fact that these soldiers down there are pure political decoration to satisfy his right-wing base, he's also starting to let huge contracts to the military and contractors for census along
the
border.
There's, the military contractors have tried to create in war zones, they're going to now try to create along that border. It's going to be hundreds of millions of dollars in contracts. It's another example of this same phenomenon.
But why don't people see through it? Because remember, if you've seen the Michael Moore film, the Fahrenheit 9/11, this was a total lame duck until 9/11 happened, and he clearly was a deer in the headlights reading to the kids. He didn't know what was happening. He flew around for a couple of days like a chicken with his head chopped off, and then after going to Camp David, meeting with Rumsfeld and Cheney and the people who really seemed to run the show, and Wolfowitz, then they came up, and I guess Rove did, they came up with this idea of the war on terrorism.
Yes.
And that made him a wartime president, and he's basically won the last two elections, 2002 and 2004, by starting wars, winning elections.
I agree with everything you just said, but in House of War, I try to show that Bush's responses to 9/11, callow as they were effectively programmed by what had been going on in this country for the previous 50 years. As someone put it, when he reached into his tool bag for a tool with which to respond to 9/11, there was only one tool there, and it was a sledgehammer. We had entirely neglected for two generations any commitment to a major effort to prevent war. We didn't have the systems or structures or skills of war prevention. It's also called diplomacy. The State Department is a a small outpost of the Defense Department in the United States at this point. There is no serious tradition of diplomatic presence in the world. We have no way of exercising influence in the world except through the military threat. And that's what Bush was, that's why Bush so readily turned to thinking of what happened on 9/11 as an act of war. It wasn't an act of war, it was a crime. And it should have been responded to as a crime. By responding to it as a war, Bush has taken us into this terrible
culture. Well, he's guaranteed our defeat because, in effect, had he called for a meeting of all the world leaders in New York where the crime took place with the funeral pyre in the air, where, after all, the United Nations is centered, and got the cooperation of all the world leaders when the world was totally sympathetic to the United States, he may have actually been able to do something about the war on terror. But this kind of cowboy shoot from the hip approach, you know, where we bomb them first and ask questions later, has led to this catastrophe throughout the world where, in fact, we're being exposed as a paper tiger because you simply cannot fight the world. You can't fight the third world. It's you true. Can feed the third world. You can house the third world, but you can't fight them.
Yes, it's true. And in House of War, I try to show the roots of this response. It was wrong-headed. It's tragic. And callow as Bush is, I'm not altogether confident that Democrats in power would have responded in a very different way.
But
which is, of course, one of the reasons we see, even to this day, no serious criticism of these policies coming from the Democrats.
Well, but you just can't, you have to be brain dead, James Carroll, not to see what's happening in the world. I mean, we thought for a while that maybe Afghanistan was working okay, even though we diverted all those resources to Iraq at the critical time. So they never kind of finished the job. Not that they really, I think, thought about really doing the job, which is an almost impossible job, which is to bring an incredibly impoverished nation in not even a nation, into some form of stability. So now that's coming back to haunt
us.
It's falling apart. All of our interventions, and some of them, you know, albeit for noble reasons, for example, East Timor, now that's falling apart.
We can't go,
in other words, we're fighting poverty. Exactly right.
We can't go around the world dropping fire on the heads of poor people and expect that they're going to do anything but see us as the enemy. And that's what the war in Afghanistan was. We bombed the poorest nation on the face of the earth. And for a moment there, we called it a victory. Of course it's not a victory. And of course the people of Afghanistan have to look at us as an occupying enemy. And the return of the Taliban is absolutely no surprise.
But what about then reinventing ourselves and not having the special forces at the tip of the spear, but having the Peace Corps at the tip of the spear?
Well, of course, there are two major threats to America's national security. One is the growing gulf between the rich and the poor around the world. We should be taking that threat on with the energy that we once took on the Soviet Union. We should be pouring our billions and billions of treasure into that problem, not into this misguided war in Iraq. What would the world be today if the billions we had spent in Iraq we had poured into the establishment of a Palestinian economy over the last 4 years? 4 years, 5 years ago, American statespeople would have said we couldn't afford it. But look, we've done it. We've spent all this money. We've basically spent it in destruction. The other thing that threatens us, of course, a true national security threat, is the degradation of the environment. And there again, the treasure that we're spending on military force cries out to be diverted, to be spent on alternative systems of energy and...
Well, it's doing something about global warming.
And establishing absolute urgent responses to global warming and so forth. I mean, there are authentic and grievous threats to our national security there.
Well, of course, it's convenient to deny the existence of global warming, even though we may be past the point where we can actually do something about it and the planet may be doomed. But the long and the short of it is that the reason that we have these deniers is that once you accept the reality of the science, it is so alarming that you're morally bound to do something. So it's very convenient that they're denying it. Because
and of course, it goes back to the same problem of the grip of that system, what Eisenhower warned us of, and what is the main subject of House of War, which is this dynamic conspiracy. It's not too strong a word to use for this. It's an implicit conspiracy. This combine, this complex, in Eisenhower's word, the military, industrial, congressional, economic complex, and in relationship to the crisis of energy, it's very clear that energy companies dominate American policy, which is a disaster, of course.
Right, and the extent that we're paying for both sides of the war on terror through our addiction to gasoline. It's interesting, I met with some CIA people the other day, just came back from meeting in with the Australian intelligence people, and they were quite surprised that the number one intelligence and defense priority in Australia was global warming. And here you can't even get the, you know, you've got people inside the White House denying his existence. So this is a sad inventory we're doing.
It is indeed. It's an enraging litany of misguided policies. But let me just jump sideways for a moment and say that we shouldn't underestimate the ability of people, ordinary people, and the people who are within range of this conversation to make their influence felt and change this. It did, in fact, happen during the Cold War.
Right. Well, after all, it's their money.
It's their money. It's our earth.
Right.
It's our earth, and these crimes now in Iraq are being committed in our name, and we must stop it. We simply must stop it.
Even if you don't want to address it on the moral level, on the practical level, it's just a big hole.
Let's call ourselves realists.
Mm.
What is the real perception that we must have here today? Mm-hmm. Clearly, it is a realist position that Iraq is a disaster for the United States, and we must bring our soldiers away from the place, out of occupation, home.
I thank you so much for joining us. I'm afraid we've run out of time, James Carroll, but again, thanks you for joining us.
My great privilege. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All the best.
Thank you. Bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and I thank Lewis Vandenberg, the producer, Jazz Shepard, the engineer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Carol Cooth, the assistant producer.